Hello, podcast listeners. My name is Christopher Patterson. I am an assistant professor at the New York Institute of Technology here in Nanjing, China, and I am the host of this podcast, New Books in Asian American Studies. Today we are joined by Leilani Nishime, who is an assistant professor of communications at the University of Washington. We will discuss her book, Undercover Asian, Multiracial Asian Americans in Visual Culture, which was published by University of Illinois Press in 2013. Undercover Asian challenges the dominant U.S. cultural narrative that imagines multiracial people as symbols of a future United States where race has ceased to function as a viable category. Nishime considers how representations of mixed race people often negate the significance of race by seeing racial mixture as an unprecedented social development that can later promise a future free of race. Opposed to this narrative, Nishime considers how various narratives of multiracial Asian Americans can rupture naturalized notions of racial difference. So Leilani, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Hi. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you. Could you begin the interview by telling us a bit about what brought you to study multiracial Asian Americans in visual media?
Okay. Well, so I had been doing work in Asian Americans more generally and visual culture because I had done work in my graduate work on Asian Americans. It was a literature degree, but I was interested in all kinds of media. And once I graduated my program, I went to ethnic studies department. And they were asking me to teach all sorts of classes, including film class, race and film class. So I started getting more interested in visual culture. I think the reason that I started working on mixed race Asians is mostly because of my students, actually. I used to teach Asian American experience class. It was one of my favorite classes to teach. And students were asking me about, well, what about mixed race Asians? And then, so I did like a week long unit on it, and students really liked it. So I expanded it to a 2 week unit, and they were still asking. So I expanded it into a class. And at that point, I started thinking there was more going on here, and there was more things that I wanted to explore. So that's pretty much what made me decide this is something I wanted to write about.
Oh, that's really interesting. Actually paying attention to how your students are responding.
Yeah, I was like, oh, look, they're all waking up when I talk about this.
And it shows it's a fair exchange. It turns into a book once you get deep enough.
Yeah, I think so. It's just nice to, I definitely wanted to write something that I thought people would read. So it helped to find something that seemed to get people excited.
It's true, actually. When I tell people what I'm interviewing people for, you know, when I was describing this book, all my friends who aren't really in academia were so much more interested, finally, in this podcast.
Great.
So I think there is something to that, right? You know, very analytically heavy, but also about subjects that everyone can kind of relate to, especially Asian Americans. I wanted to start the interview by taking apart each of those terms in your subtitle, the multiracial Asian Americans and visual culture. Yeah. First of all, the term multiracial, rather than mixed race or HAPA or something else, why use this term, and who kind of counts as multiracial? Like, do half Irish, half Italian people also seem to count, or is it mostly like people of color?
So I decided to use the word multiracial, although at this point I think I could also use mixed race. When I started writing the book, I think there was a lot of discussion about which terms to use. And there was, I think, a perception that mixed race tended to mean, tended to reinforce the idea that there are these distinct racial groups that then get mixed together. Mm-hmm. And I think people were interested in using the term multiracial because they felt that it de-emphasized that biological element. I think at this point, though, people use the terms fairly interchangeably, and actually mixed race is becoming more popular among academics. So it was less a sort of ethical decision for me and more in terms of what seemed to be the way that people use that term.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason I didn't use HAPA, though, was much more deliberate. So there is quite a bit of controversy over the term HAPA. So it became very popular, I think, amongst college-age students who are interested in identifying as mixed-race Asian, and mostly in California is kind of where it started. And they were using a term that had been quite popular in Hawaii. But a lot of the people who were part of a kind of Hawaii Renaissance, a Hawaii sovereignty movement, felt that the term was being taken out of context and was being appropriated by people who didn't really feel a connection to Hawaii. Mm-hmm. And so I was kind of aware of those conversations going on. And so that's, I've made a decision not to use the term Hapa, even though I think it has a lot of emotional resonance for quite a few people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The decision over, I guess, the words to use seems also kind of a symptom of how we talk about mixed race. Yeah. Or don't talk about it, I guess. We seem to lack a vocabulary, I guess, to adequately deal with mixed race people. You begin the book talking about the dominant narrative that we usually have about mixed race. You go over some magazine articles about Generation Mixed, you know, we have this idea of like mixed race people as a kind of bridge between cultures. But what was the dominant narrative of mixed race people, and what seemed wrong with it as you were beginning your book?
Yeah. Well, I think that the dominant narrative was really about how mixed race was a sign of racial progress, and also that it was a path towards getting rid of race, that race was going to go away because people were mixing. And I think that it was often said in opposition to earlier ways of thinking about mixed race as being impure or being a problematic identity category. And so in contrast to that, you could see the interest or the willingness to claim a mixed race identity as being progressive in some way. But I think that got translated into ways that I think were really politically regressive. Mm-hmm. And that conception of mixed race meaning the end of race really made it so that I think it gave people an out. It made it easier to not really deal with racial problems that we have currently, to sort of feel like if we just sit back and do nothing, then race is going to go away and fix itself somehow.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of like in some science fiction narratives that also get spoofed, right? We go in the future and everyone's the same tint of brown or something.
Yeah. I don't even think you need to go to science fiction for that, right? I think there are people who would believe that's happening even now. Mm-hmm. They sometimes call it the browning of America, that we're all going to be some kind of undifferentiated brown shade of brown. Mm-hmm. And so there's not going to be any races left.
And then I guess we'll all be happy and everything.
Yes, then we'll hold hands and there'll be rainbows and we'll all drink Coke. It'll be great.
So let's get to the second term in that subtitle, which is Asian Americans. You do spend time in your book talking about how this discourse of mixed race kind of grows out or is linked to African-American ideas about racial mixture, biraciality, racial passing, mulattoes, and all this. How are Asian-American narratives different than that? Or how is mixed race, as we talk about it now, different from the discourse of like biracial people, quadroons, and all that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's the reason that I wanted to use a term like multiracial Asian Americans, which is so long and, you know, kind of unwieldy, is because I really wanted to keep that element of Asian Americans in there, because I think the ways that people generally, if you just say multiracial, if you just say mixed race, people generally will think about black and white mixed. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, just because of the longer history of U.S. racial relations that we tend to think about race in a binary way about black and white. But I think that mixed race Asian Americans, because Asian Americans themselves have a very specific kind of history, that I wanted to really trace that kind of history and really wanted to look at how mixed race Asian Americans, I mean, in some ways parallel. I think there's a lot of ways you can see crossover, but also that they have there's a distinct element to it. You know, for me, part of it is thinking about how mixed race Asian Americans, in some sense, exaggerate a lot of the stereotypes I think we already have about Asian Americans. Mm-hmm. So that really strong narrative of assimilation and of post-racial identities, all those kinds of things that I think often get mapped onto Asians in the U.S. get mapped on, you know, tenfold when mm-hmm. you're talking about mixed race Asian Americans.
Mm-hmm. You also include, like, I guess if I were to just hear that term multiracial Asian American, I would immediately think white and Asian, white and Japanese, white and Chinese. But you also consider people who are part black, mm-hmm. part Asian, part, and we could also think about people who are part Hispanic, part Asian or something. Like it doesn't seem to have the same immediate assumptions as something like biracial would.
Yeah, maybe. Although I think you're right that mostly when people think about mixed race Asians, it's mostly white and Asian. I did try to. So I did also want to talk about Asian African American mixtures or mixed race people in the book, partly because, and it's not. I think I could have easily also talked about Asian Native Americans or Asian Latinos. I'm not easily. I would have to learn a lot before I did that. But I didn't include other groups because I felt like I had so much to deal with just by thinking in sort of these three categories that I didn't want to end up being kind of flavor of the month. I wanted to think about things in more depth. But I also thought it was important because I think that to understand racial relations in the U.S., you have to understand the black-white binary. And so I wanted to also think about how Asians are positioned in relation to African Americans. I think that's really crucial in thinking about what it means to be Asian American.
Yeah, it seems like there was a time, or maybe there still is, where if you're doing Asian American scholarship, sometimes it would be to just really emphasize the difference between Asian American and white, and kind of just to resist that racial, the black-white binary. But you seem to kind of just accept like that, yes, this is usually how we see race in the U.S., and this is how, and instead of trying to ignore it or deviate from it, you're looking at Asian Americans through that lens, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes, so one of the things I talk about in the book is this kind of rhetorical move that I see constantly when I talk about Asians as being beyond black and white. I think partly because it helps sell books. It helps sell books. But I felt like I really wanted to push back against that and not think about Asian Americans as beyond black and white or outside of black and white or somehow a cure for the problem of the racial binary. But I think that we're very much embedded in that binary, and where the Asians are used in the U.S. to prop it up.
Let's go to the third term in that subtitle, which is a visual culture. I'm sure you deal with students who ask the same question, but let's just get it out there. Why visual representations? How do visual representations of multiracial bodies tell us something different than, other types of analysis, literary, statistical? And this goes back to images of the mixed race body as being kind of ambiguous and having to make a choice or being seen as half and half. And how that kind of construes this post-racial narrative about mixed-race people.
Yeah. Well, I really became interested in visual culture partly because there seemed to be such a paradox in the way that we talk about race in the U.S. So I think it's a pretty widely accepted idea that there's no biological race. So, in most freshman year classrooms, first year classrooms in college, students learn that there's no biological basis for race. And so most, I think, you see it on the cover of Time magazine, whatever, most people will argue that's true. And yet at the same time, we have this whole way of seeing race, right? We walk down the street and we see different races of people. So for me, that seems like a real paradox to try and think through. Why do we still perceive race? Why do we still see race, even if intellectually we believe it doesn't exist? So that's kind of was my starting point, even before I started thinking about mixed race Asian Americans as being a way to think through that question. Part of it is because the way I got to thinking about mixed race Asian Americans is that I would sometimes tell people, you could play those games about, who's mixed race, who isn't. And I would tell people that, say, Keanu Reeves or Meg Tilly, who was a big star at the time, that were mixed race Asian. And I would, why do you think that they're not recognized as mixed race Asian? People say, well, because they don't look Asian. And that, for me, was a really interesting kind of response, that this was something that somehow seemed to be inside somebody's body, that we believe that, it goes back to that biological belief. And so I wanted to think about why is it that we don't have the terms or the visual terms, I would say. I think the term I use is visual vocabulary. So why we haven't kind of learned how to see mixed race Asians. I think we, when we were talking earlier, you were talking about Hawaii, and I think Hawaii is a really interesting example, right? There's many mixed race people, mixed race Asians in Hawaii, and so I think there's a much, they're much more visible there. I think people recognize mixed race Asians much more readily there, and it's not because they look different than they do when they're in another state, right? Yeah. It's just that people have that. Have learned how to recognize people who are mixed race Asian.
Yeah, let's. Why don't we spend a moment on Hawaii in that case? Because I was also very intrigued by how you situated Hawaii as a kind of example of brownwashing. Can you explain, I guess, how you see it that way, and perhaps how the discourse about Hawaii then feeds into how we see Barack Obama, particularly?
Oh, yeah. I don't know about Barack Obama, but. I think in Hawaii, so I use the example of Hawaii because it's such a popular storyline, I think, to talk about Hawaii as the melting pot of the Pacific. And people imagine it as a space that all these different races, Native Hawaiians and people from all parts of Asia and white Americans all got together and they all mix together and all live harmoniously and it's sort of the aloha spirit. And I think that kind of vision of what it means to have a mixed race future often gets, I think, sort of mapped onto Hawaii, right? People think about Hawaii as an example of how the future is going to be. But what I talk about in the book is that that vision of what Hawaii is about tends to really come from the outside, come from people who don't live in Hawaii and don't really have a sense that things are not like a happy melting pot there. And I think, not necessarily like an unhappy melting pot, but I think in Hawaii, what you have is, I think, a different kind of recognition of what it means to be mixed. So I think there's a lot of different names for different kinds of racial mixtures in Hawaii, and those are important kinds of identity markers. And so what you have instead of a disappearance of race is, I think, a reconfiguration of it. Right? It means something a little different there, but that doesn't mean that it's kind of all gone away. And I think that story of kind of this happy mixture ignores, you know, the legacy of white supremacy in Hawaii. It ignores the oppression of Native Hawaiians. There's all sorts of really difficult political issues in Hawaii that get covered over in that story of, you know, the melting pot of the Pacific.
Yeah, and it seems like this a vocabulary, I guess, to recognize different types of mixed race people as we kind of get in Hawaii would probably develop anyways if that dream, I guess, of kind of a brownwashing, we became closer to that, I suppose. We would still develop a vocabulary for how to recognize different types of mixed race people, but it might not be as critical.
Yeah. I think this idea that mixed race people are going to lead to this kind of brown future really ignores how long people have been mixing in the U.S., right? Basically, since there's been a country, people have been racially mixing and yet still have racial distinctions. So I think it's locating the cause of racial boundaries in the wrong place, right? It's relocating it in different kinds of bodies rather than seeing it as this kind of social political structure that then gets written onto different kinds of bodies.
Yeah, let's shoot then towards the historical context and how this discourse developed. And one thing I really liked about your first chapter and your preface was that you considered how we usually tend to see the discourse towards mixed race developing after Loving versus Virginia, the 1967 court case, and how that's kind of seen as an origin point for when this supposedly new mixed race culture started to develop. But you offer a more complex history, I guess, of negotiations and imperial interests. Right? Can you explain, I guess, how Loving versus Virginia got placed as this kind of origin point and how the history of it is actually much more complex?
Well, I mean, I think Loving versus Virginia, it's partly because it is so significant. I mean, I think that is partly why it became this origin point, because it was this big Supreme Court case. It got a lot of attention. It was a Supreme Court case that allowed a white man and a black woman to be married, and it overturned all the laws against mixed race marriages in the country. And so I think it became this sort of signal moment, partly because I think it allowed us to tell this history – the point of coming in our history, too, was when the civil rights movement was really gaining momentum, where it seemed to be working. Mm-hmm. And so I think it gets memorialized as being part of this moment when racial barriers were falling, when sort of the promise of the civil rights movement was coming true. And mm-hmm. so it's seen as this really kind of hopeful moment of racial reconciliation. Mm-hmm. You know, I think what we've seen since then, particularly for people who work in ethnic studies, for example, right, is that a lot of that promise didn't actually pay out. And that to kind of leap forward to thinking about post-racial world is because we have sort of told the story about the civil rights movement and the success of the civil rights movement that ignores a lot of existing inequalities. So what I write about in the book is that maybe we should think about why that's an origin point and what would happen if we looked at other kinds of origin moments, originary moments. And so what we might do, for instance, is go to the 1946 War Rights Act, mm-hmm. 45, I think, in the book. Sorry. And that's the act that made it legal for if soldiers married men from other countries, that those women would be allowed to have citizens. And so this had a really it's not very neutral, right? It's a kind of racially neutral law, but it had this really disproportionate impact, which was that at the time, Asian women were not allowed to become U.S. citizens. Mm-hmm. And so it allowed this loophole in the law that allowed Asian women to immigrate and become citizens because of, you know, post-World War II. So there were a lot of soldiers who were marrying Japanese women in particular, but also women in other parts of Asia, and allowing them to come to the U.S. and become citizens. So for me, that's a really different kind of origin story, partly because of how strictly gendered it is and the way it was so strictly racialized. So it was almost all, or I think all, white men and the women. And so they were all marrying Asian women, right? I mean, they were marrying European women as well. Mm-hmm. But in terms of race, you see a lot of what gets institutionalized is white men marrying Asian women, and these are not just sort of randomly people who meet on the street, but that you have a conquering army marrying women who are in countries that the U.S. has some imperial intentions towards. Right? It tells a very different kind of story of, instead of thinking about it as being this moment of equality and the blooming of civil rights, you can see it as really being really implicated in certain kinds of national and racial and gender boundaries.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. When I mentioned to some friends here in China that I was interviewing you for about this book about mixed race, you know, they are also mixed race, and we, I guess your students probably had similar experiences where, in much of the world, especially in Asia, people don't ask me, what, if I'm mixed, they ask, you know, what nation my mother was from.
Oh, right. That's the assumption, right? Is it's going to be your mother.
Yeah. Nobody ever asks if my dad is from, is from the Philippines or from Korea or something. It's always, oh, is your mom Chinese? Is your mom Korean? And like, it doesn't have to be, but it is. But
it's because of these historical patterns. It's not like it just so happens, mm-hmm. which I think is often how people imagine, you know, it's just luck or just happenstance. I don't think that's true.
Yeah, in this typical, I guess what we envision as a kind of typical mixed marriage and mixed race children, as you outline, is not only has these colonial overtones, but is also always very heteronormative, very gender normative, and then produces children who are kind of seen in this utopic, futuristic dream thing. Can you explain all the expectations that seem to come with mixed families, and you know the role of the husband and wife?
Yeah. Well, so one of the chapters in the book is about the TV series Battlestar Galactica. Mm-hmm. And I think that series really plays out the kind of expectations that we have for the mixed race families in the U.S. Mm-hmm. So in it, I talk about how I saw a shift in terms of these kind of colonial narratives. I think the colonial narrative for a lot of the 20th century was that the U.S. was kind of a father figure, and Asia, they were sort of childlike, and they needed to be rescued and helped. Mm-hmm. And often the mixed race child in something like, say, M. Butterfly, gets taken away from the Asian culture and raised in the U.S. culture and gets fully assimilated. And often the mother gets left out of that story.
Mm-hmm.
So you could see that maybe a lot in the 1970s and 1980s, there are a lot of stories about children from the Vietnam War, Amerasian children from the Vietnam War that told that same story. And what I saw going on was a shift in that story to be more about this heteronormative mixed race family. And it keeps that same kind of gender and racial binary where you usually have a white father and an Asian mother. But this time, I think the family stays together. You see much more of a family unit remain connected. But I think what happens is that you get a different kind of story about Asia, the role of Asia, and especially Asian migrants and immigrants, mm-hmm. that their role then is to kind of reject their home culture and go to the U.S. and kind of fall in love, whether that's actually with a person or with the country itself,
mm-hmm.
and sort of dedicate themselves fully to this new country. Mm-hmm. And so you see it played out in very extreme ways in a show like Battlestar Galactica. So you have a character who's played by an Asian woman, and she's supposed to be an alien. But there's a episode that's mainly about her, and she gives them a virus, or she allows them to have a virus or something like that, that would wipe out her entire race of people. They call them Cylons. And she willingly agreed to do this probably to show her loyalty to the humans in it, mm-hmm. which I thought was really a kind of a devastating indictment. I think one of the other kind of really really upsetting to me, I guess, or when I was doing this analysis, that I thought was quite typical and very upsetting, was that you see a real differentiation too. So in the show, there's the idea that she's cloned, she's mm-hmm. got many multiples, and while she's allowed to be married and fall in love and become part of the dominant class, there's all these other clones of her, and some of whom are sex workers, and some of whom are kind of industry, I guess you would call it. Working class kind of work. And they also remain fairly alienated from humans. They don't fall in love. They don't get married. They don't become part of this kind of sexual family. Mm-hmm. And they always remain pretty alienated in the show. And towards the end of the show, I hope this doesn't spoil it for anyone, but towards the end of the show, the character who's really well integrated ends up shooting her clone, who's like one of these kind of lower class people. So I think it also really depends on differentiating kind of good Asians,
mm-hmm.
Which are the ones who fall in love and you know, whatever, become assimilated, and the bad, quote unquote, bad Asians, who are more working class, and who are there, who come to the U.S. For economic reasons rather than because they, you know, have bought into the kind of ideology of the U.S. as being superior.
Mm-hmm. Before we get into the chapters of your book, was there anything else that really surprised you as you were doing research for this book or completing it? I mean, you do devote two chapters to Keanu Reeves, and you seem like very like you found
obsessed. You mean, do you think I sound obsessed?
Yeah, maybe a little obsessed. But yeah. Was there anything that really surprised you as you were doing work for, or as you were doing this kind of research? That maybe changed your expectations of what you were going for in the beginning?
Oh, yeah, I felt like that was happening all the time, actually. Mm-hmm. This ended up being a book that I wasn't really expecting it to be.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I even started out thinking that I was going to write an entire book about mixed race people.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a bit of a surprise. I think, yeah, there was so much of it where I just felt like it was moving ahead of me. I was kind of running to catch up with the things that I was finding. So I feel like a lot of this worked that way.
Mm. So let's get to your second chapter, which is on Keanu Reeves, and then we'll get back to Keanu Reeves again with the fifth chapter. But this also has a fantastic title that I just wanted to parse through a little bit, which is Queer Keanu, The Politics of Bad Acting in the Era of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I'm tempted to go through every word of that title and devote a question to every word. But instead, let me just ask, what is the relationship of those terms, the terms queer, bad acting, don't ask, don't tell, and Keanu Reeves?
Yeah. Well, So the title, the beginning part of the title came from the rumors about Keanu Reeves being gay that were, you know, really popular in the 90s. And actually, the whole thing came out of, I had given a talk about Keanu Reeves because I've been thinking about him for a long time, a while back. And after I gave the talk, somebody in the audience raised their hand and said, well, what about all these rumors of him being gay? And I was like, I have nothing to say to that because I just really haven't thought about it. But it got me thinking about it. And I think it, for me, it seems really fundamental now. And so what I talk about is how very few people actually talk about Keanu Reeves as being mixed race, which is considering that it's mentioned quite often in his publicity material and often articles will mention it as well. And yet there still seems to be this way that every time it gets mentioned, it gets forgotten again. And so I thought there's kind of that weird gap. Then there was also all these rumors about him being gay. And so for me, it came together around the really specific rumors about him being involved with this movie producer, record producer named David Geffen. And those rumors sort of blossomed in the mid-90s, which was the same time that the Don't Ask, Don't Tell legislation was ramping up. And so that was the military legislation of saying military personnel, they removed the law saying that they couldn't be gay, but they had to not say it. Like if they said we're gay, then they could be kicked out. And so there was all the popular conversation about closeting and outing and what it meant to be in the closet and what it meant to be outed. And there were these newspapers like The Advocate that were outing a lot of people who had formerly been in the closet, gay politicians mostly, as part of the trying to respond to the AIDS epidemic. So what I argue is that we had sort of lost a lot of the rhetoric, a lot of language we had around mixed race people. And like 1950s America, there was all these movies and books and stuff about mixed race people in passing. Those things weren't available anymore, so we lost that vocabulary. And instead, we're gaining all this vocabulary about outing and closeting. And I felt like that one vocabulary got mapped onto the other. And so I think part of the reason that Keanu Reeves was perceived to be gay was because we didn't really have a language for talking about mixed race. There was no way to make that legible, I think, in popular culture.
And what about bad acting?
Well, so it would be no surprise, I think, to people to know that he has really bad reviews. And in chapter, that was actually one of the most fun parts, was reading movie reviews for bad reviews. And there were so many. But what I was noticing is that many of the reviews really harp on the idea that he was, he had no depth and that he seemed kind of fake in some way or shallow or wooden and robotic. These are all kind of the terms people used. And so for me, it seemed to really be also about these questions of authenticity, that we want to believe that good acting, or we perceive good acting to be people showing you their inner selves, showing you their true depth, showing you their true nature. And I think Keanu Reeves, in his publicity and in the way he sort of built his star image, was all about refusing that kind of essentialism. Right? So when they asked him if he's gay, for instance, he said, no, I'm not, but you never know. Right? He liked to keep that ambiguity. The same way there was this kind of ambiguity about his racial identity. I think all those kinds of things that, for me, made him really appealing, also, I think, fed into this story or this idea of him as being a bad actor because he doesn't sort of fake a depth for us, right? I mean, good acting means that you could fake me deep. And he doesn't do that, not in his movies, I don't think, and not in his star persona either.
It seems interesting to kind of compare his acting with the way other Japanese actors or so, or Chinese, might be considered in the United States, where if you're like wooden and show no emotion, but you own this kind of Japanese identity, they probably would have read him very differently as an actor.
I would think so. You know, I don't think it's all about technique, right? I think there's also this extra narrative going on.
So let's move off Keanu Reeves just for now. We'll come back to him. Your third chapter seems like the most timely chapter in the book. It's about the rise and fall of Tiger Woods.
Yeah.
And you consider his celebrity as a kind of representation of a double minority, but also as a kind of colorblind celebrity culture that becomes very colorblind, but it then changes after his big scandal. So how does perceptions of Tiger Woods change before and after after the scandal, and how is it partially determined by his multiracial background?
Yeah. Actually, I think largely determined by his multiracial background. Mm. So I think a lot of his celebrity before, when he first became famous, had to do with him fulfilling this storyline that we're having, this mythology that we're talking about mixed race people, about him being a sort of this perfect mixture of all different kinds of people. And because he was this perfect mixture, there was no racial identity at all. Mm-hmm. So people would often talk about him as being sort of bland in some way. Mm. And I talked about him in some of his ads. We don't get to see much of his body, which is odd for someone who's an athlete. Mm. And probably the most famous one is this ad that was analyzed by Hiram Perez about the I Am Tiger Woods ads, where they have all these different people, children and adults and people of different races, saying, I am Tiger Woods. Mm. And you don't actually see Tiger Woods in that commercial at all. Mm. So he is... body just completely erased, right? His race and his racial body and him, he gets erased and becomes this kind of every man, every race together. Mm. And I think he was really celebrated for doing that. And then I think what happened after the scandal about his affairs is that a lot of the kind of racial anxieties that we had that were being kind of covered over by this pretty story comes to the fore, right? It really erupts through that veneer we had about colorblindness. And he gets really intensely racialized after his after the scandal breaks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I guess he did something naughty or something.
Yeah, he had, you know, he had an affair with a few women, but mm-hmm. they acted like he, I mean, there was comparisons to O.J. Simpson, who was accused of murdering someone. Mm-hmm. I think that's a pretty big distinction. Mm-hmm. And yet to compare those two acts, I think it has something to do with how badly people felt betrayed mm-hmm. By him not being this kind of perfect colorblind star.
Mm-hmm. And then to kind of be cast as like diseased with sex, you know, obsession with
yeah.
sex and all this, I don't know if that would have happened otherwise, you know.
So yeah, I don't think so.
Yeah, and he's contagious or something.
Yeah, and people really harped on the fact that many of the women he had affairs were white women and mm-hmm. blonde white women. Yeah. That seemed to be really kind of a point, even if they weren't actually saying it, would mm-hmm. show the flash pictures of like a, you know, a compilation of all the women he had affairs with, and it was really clear that they were making this point about white women mm-hmm. and that he was, you know, sort of lusting after white women. And I think they used that as a way to racialize them as African-American, mm-hmm. you know, kind of emphasize that as being a kind of pathology. So I think they brought up all these old stereotypes as a way to, I don't know, it seems like as a punishment in some way for mm-hmm. feeling betrayed.
Mm-hmm. Let's move to the fourth chapter just briefly, since we already talked a bit about Battlestar Galactica. Yeah. But anything else to say about that before we move on? Its relationship to neocolonialism, the celebration of heterosexual romance, particularly because there are homosexual romances in the series, but not. Mm-hmm. But then this one seems very actually heteronormative between the cyborg and the human.
Yeah, which seems strange, right? It sort of seems the weird thing about this story is that there's a mixed race child in the story, mm-hmm. and all these different families like want to claim her as their kid, and the one who wins in the end is this mixed race family, which seems like so surprising that would be the idealized family. Huh. But I think it's because it's trying on all these other different kinds of family formations that are not this heteronormative nuclear family formation, and all the other people fail, right? Mm. The perfect family is the one that is so strictly organized along gender lines, which is this cyborg human family. I mean, it's so weird. There's, you know, the only person you ever see doing housework in the entire series is the, you know, the woman who's the Asian woman who's in this relationship. It's really weird.
Yeah, weird but typical, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, I mean, just, yeah, I could tell you stories about living in China. I'll try not to go into it. But let's...
No, you'll have to tell me after the interview.
Yeah, but let's go into the second half of your book then. And the way you structure the book is very clever, I have to say, in that it feels like a very, like an actual book, I guess, in the way that things overlap and you get back to everything, as opposed to like a bunch of articles that might have been separately produced. Mm-hmm. The second half, though, mirrors the first half of the book, seems to focus less on the kind of undercover aspect to the multiracial Yeah. Asian American and more on the various ways that multiraciality has been acknowledged, commodified, or exposed racial thinking in the U.S.
Yeah.
So let's go to your sixth chapter, which, yay, again, is on Keanu Reeves.
But only kind of.
Only kind of. But it uses the multiracial, like, you know, it kind of asks, so what if we all saw Keanu Reeves as multiracial? And then what happens differently when we read the film series? I love arguments like this where it just kind of, you know, this, I try to do this in my own work. You know, what if we read it this way? What if we really like took gender into account? Then what happens? And usually things get so much more interesting. Even silly, stupid things get really fun.
Yeah.
So can you just let us in on how the Matrix film series would change, become richer and more different if we read it as a kind of multiracial narrative?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think a lot of people, when they see this film, see Keanu Reeves is white. But I think it, and a lot of people read it as telling a really familiar story, which, you know, I could definitely, I think that is a valid reading as well of, you know, the kind of white savior who comes in and fixes everything for the people of color. Mm-hmm. But I think you can also read this as, you know, what if we took seriously the fact that Keanu Reeves is a multiracial actor, and how might that change the storyline? And so in The Matrix, like the fake world of The Matrix, you know, is almost the white. Mm. And then the kind of the rebellion is a conglomeration of different ethnic groups, mostly like, you know, not non-white ethnic groups.
Mm-hmm.
And so Keanu Reeves then becomes, or the character Neo becomes this bridge between these two worlds.
Mm-hmm.
And by the final part of the movie, he's the only one who can move back and forth without any kind of prosthetics. So he can move back and forth between the two worlds in ways other people can't.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it tells kind of a grim story, because what happens at the very end is that he gets left out. I think he's blinded, mm-hmm. and then he's kind of beaten up, and he's left lying in no man's land, and the rest of the world, the rest of the people kind of go on living their own separate world after that.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of doesn't leave any space for mixed race people or mixed race bodies. But I think one of the interesting things for me is the way that it does a sort of metaphorical work of how we think about mixed race people, because what happens is that in the storyline, these two worlds, the white world and the people of color, are locked in this repetitive cycle. Because of there's a glitch in the Matrix, right? There's supposed to be a bug in the machine, mm-hmm. the computer program where they all live, which causes the same thing to repeat over and over again. And that's so much a way that we think about how race operates in the U.S. Mm-hmm. That, you know, black and white people have never gotten along, will never get along. That race is something that is, you know, part. It seems to be transcending history, mm-hmm. right? We always think about black people and white. Always having been black and white in the same way throughout history. And so the figure of Neo becomes a way in the story of repairing that glitch in the Matrix,
mm.
and allowing for history to start somehow, and allowing not even for history to start, but for all the past history to be wiped clean, and we get a clean slate and we get to start over again.
Mm.
And I think that's much of the way, maybe this is why mixed race, that mixed race mythology is so appealing to us, mm-hmm. is because we want to have that idea that we don't have to deal with all the injustices of the past, and we can just, maybe we can just wipe it all clean and start fresh and not have to repay all those kinds of racial debts that we have, that we've built up, you know, over the past years.
Mm-hmm. And this kind of speaks to something that you're doing throughout the book, where, you know, you read something like The Matrix and make it far richer and more interesting, but you don't seem to tag on a particular like political agenda or, you know, perspective. You've named it as ambiguous in a lot of ways. And you also continue this in the next chapter on Kimora Lee Simmons and her celebrity. You know, I guess I hadn't actually heard of her until I knew her, but I found out a lot about her.
You don't watch enough trashy reality TV, that's why.
Yeah, not enough, as I should. I need to work on that. But yeah, so she seems, and I get this a lot when there's like a mixed race celebrity, people will just say, oh, they're so incredibly beautiful. But then they also seem to have this kind of surface that's hard to penetrate, I guess, or hard to see as like in depth. And she seems to capitalize a lot on being mixed race as a celebrity. But again, it's hard to tie a particular, you know, is it resistant? Is it not kind of ideas to it? And it seems very politically ambiguous, like watching the Matrix films with this in mind, right? Like maybe Tiger Woods also, right? It's very difficult to name a particular perspective on any of it.
Yeah, I think none of the, I think I'm interested in looking at media that is, ambiguous might be a word for it, ones that we haven't really decided what it means, or at least I haven't decided what it means. I feel like those are really interesting moments for me. Partly, so the image that always comes to my mind when I think about this is Josephine Baker, you know, the African-American dancer who went to Paris like in the early part of the 20th century. At the time, she did a burlesque act, and at the time, she was really not very respectable at all, and everyone thought she was actually kind of awful and exploitative of the African-American stereotypes. Now I think a lot of people look back at her and see her as a pioneer and see her within this kind of context where she was escaping a lot of the way that she was terrorized in the U.S. by moving to Paris. And, you know, they kind of rehabilitated her. And so I sometimes try and think about the images that I look at now as, you know, are these moments that we can rehabilitate in some way? Are there other ways we can read this? I think particularly because I think that often women and people of color are not able to make these kinds of political moves that are read as political. They're often, the things that they do are often much more limited and constrained by social forces. So it's very difficult for them to become these kinds of revolutionary figures because we don't recognize the work they do. Right? I think it's difficult to recognize the work they do. And so that's partly what I mean, not that I think Kimora Lee Simmons revolutionary figure, but that I want to be able to recognize minor resistances or miniature resistances, and think about, is this something that could be more meaningful? Maybe it is and maybe it isn't, but I think we will miss a lot of things if we're always saying, well, this is not completely revolutionary, so it's not worth thinking about or not worth looking at.
Yeah, it's a very freeing type of argument, like the dealing with what we can call, I guess, microaggressions, micro resistances that later on might be huge, as far as we know.
And maybe not, right? Maybe it gets buried and we never hear about it again. I'm hoping that that's not true. That isn't how it ends up.
So anything else to say about Simmons before we move on to the next chapter?
I think partly this was the chapter where I felt like I finally got a chance to talk a bit more about class. I think she's really interesting in terms of the way that she also, and I think that's one way that kind of undercuts her potential of actually making some more meaningful resistance is because she's really, I think, caught up in a lot of these kinds of class politics that make it difficult for her to be seen as somebody who people could emulate or think about herself in as part of a more collective movement because so much of it is based on her having this kind of class privilege that isn't really shared.
So let's move on to the last chapter, and this is probably the one that seems most to really be about a particular counter-narrative or an attempt to make a counter-narrative against a dominant narrative. whereas the others are a bit more ambiguous, or, you know, one has to read them in particular ways to do that. The last chapter, you focus on Kip Fulbeck, the visual artist, and his famous work, The Hop Up Project. And I think this is the same as, like, there's a book made about it, right? Or like a picture.
Yeah, there is.
So you argue that the this representation of multiracial Asian Americans in the book and in the project provides a distinct counter narrative to genetic science and the way genetic science has kind of named and also erased mixed race. Can you tell us, I guess, what this dominant narrative is, and then how Fulbeck's work counters it?
Yeah. Well, so I talk about the ways that genetics seems to be reinvigorating race in some ways. Mm-hmm. So when they announced the Human Genome Project, you know, one of the big announcements was, we figured out that race is not, you know, is an invention, right? It's a cultural invention, and that there's as much genetic variation within racial groups as there is between racial groups, so that it isn't a valid, you know, way of organizing the world. And yet since then, what we've seen genetics really being used as a way to prove racial difference. And so there's a great show called Radiolab. That's they have podcasts. You can look them up. And they had this episode on race that talked about all these different ways that race is being used to, say, for police profiling, or the things where people take cheek swabs and they figure out what race they like, what their the race of their ancestors, that sort of thing. And so for a lot of these genetic scientists, though, mixed race people are kind of the problem with trying to talk about genetic groups. And so there's often this kind of like impulse to try and find, you know, try and collect DNA from groups before they get too mixed, because that's somehow going to mess up their their genetic distinctions from other groups. And so I wanted to think about how can we look at mixed race people rather than being the problem of genetics, as being a way for us to rethink how it is that we are using genetics to shore up this this social construct, right, of race. And it's certainly not the first time that you see science being, I think, misused that way.
Yeah, and then the Fulbeck work, how does this provide a counter-narrative to that?
Yeah. So what I see happening in the Fulbeck work, and let me just mention, I get more pushback, I think, from this chapter than just about any. I think most people find Fulbeck's work to be really problematic, and see it as reifying kind of exotic or exotic views of mixed race people, or making them into spectacles. So I just want to mention that I am aware of the fact that this is against the grain. But what I think is interesting, so the in his art, he's got a photograph of someone who's mixed race, kind of looking straight at the screen, and then a typed list at the bottom of different either racial or ethnic identifiers. And I think he asked the people themselves to tell him what, you know, what to write. And then a sort of handwritten note. And so he asks everybody, what are you? And they have a handwritten note under their pictures that say, what are you? And people answer it in all sorts of ways. You know, they make jokes, or sometimes they you know, they say where their parents are from, or they, people answer it in all sorts of different ways. But for me, I found it really interesting because it allows us to think about racial identities as being coming from these multiple spaces that, for a lot of times, say for genetic scientists, part of the problem is trying to reduce race to the single way of identifying it, right? Race is this genetic code, or race is where what part of the world your ancestor came from. And so the example I use is from a study that was done in Barbados, I think it is. And the person writing about it called was saying that they collected all this different kind of information from people, but when they turned in their surveys, people had to pick one race as a way to identify themselves. And so what I want to talk about is if we could think about race as being as coming from multiple sources, mm-hmm. and being a negotiation between all these different kinds of narratives and discourses, I think that's how it is that race actually inheres and embodies for us. And I think that his work kind of allows us to see that.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. I mean, it always seems like everyone has to start with a big definition of what they think race is, and then it could be very, it seems like so overdetermined by so many different narratives and forces. We're running out of time, so can you tell us about any new research that you've been working on now?
Sort of bits and pieces of stuff. I was working mainly on graphic novels. I'm interested in Asian diaspora and graphic novels. So I guess that's kind of the shorthand version of what I'm working on now.
Okay. Very cool. What particular novels?
I just finished presenting on The Arrival, which is a Sean Tan. It's like a wordless graphic novel about migration. Okay. And then the Amulet series. There's like the best-selling kids series from Scholastic Books.
Oh, okay.
So, and it's kind of more of a adventure fantasy series of books.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. Well, I want to thank you very much for being on the show. I think it was
thank you for inviting me. This has been fun.
Well, thank you again, and take care. Thank you for listening to my interview with Leilani Nishime on her book, Undercover Asian, Multiracial Asian Americans in Visual Culture. If you have any questions, grievances, or suggestions for books for this podcast, please send me a message on the New Books in Asian American Studies Facebook page. See you next time.